Tony Criz is here from Portland today to speak with us and to speak to us. And I'm excited to have him here. I've met Tony a couple times. He's good friends with John Pattison, and I've met him with John a couple times. I read Tony. Tony's an author and a speaker, and I read his book two or three years ago, Aloof. It's called Aloof. I don't know if anyone else read that book. Yeah, Lori. And Tony expressed in that book his close relationship with Richard Twiss. You know, and Richard's been was part of our lives here for 40 years, really, our church and friendship. And when I read about Tony's relationship, I just thought, well, how cool it would be to have Tony come and be here with us, and we can maybe bless him in that way, and he can bless us. And Lori, you know, Lori being here with us, because when Lori joined our church, moved up here from Albany, Richard was coming at Easter, and we were like all excited, and then he died. And it was like, you know, God always has a plan. And but as Tony expressed that in his book, just his relationship and friendship, I thought it would be neat. And I kind of reached out to Tony and made some connections for him to come. I think, Tony, you know, we hear a lot of messages here from pastors, because John and I and Christine and others, you know, we kind of have, I don't think Tony is a pastor. I think he has a different message from that comes from a different part of the body of Christ. Someone who's maybe more of a poet, more of a prophet, more of a, I'm not sure what. I might be totally wrong there. I don't know Tony that well. But it's, we need these different voices to come and encourage us in different ways. So in that, I'm just excited to have Tony here today with us. So Tony, I'll let you take it. You want to stand? And kids, yeah.
Nine days ago, I stood in front of 3,000 college students, and and I told Richard stories. And I'm not even going to try and do it here in front of you guys, because you guys see that. And with Lori here, I'm just like, I know I would be completely worthless. And I draw the attention to myself, and that's the opposite of what I want to do, so. Okay, good start. So I get frustrated. I have three boys that are becoming teenagers, and they have hormones and opinions. I have a yard that I can't keep up with. I have contractors that were supposed to be out of my house 4 months ago, and they're still there trying to fix my kitchen. So I think I get frustrated almost every day. And then, in related news, I'm teaching a class right now at a seminary in Florida, and I can't get a hold of my students because they don't have power, and they may not have homes. There are 73 dead so far from Hurricane Irma, and millions still don't have electricity. In related news, I was reading this morning that the government of Myanmar is burning to the ground entire villages, entire regions, because of a particular tribe of people, a Muslim tribe of people that happens to live in those villages. And children are being burned alive. In related news, current statistics according to the UN is that there are 30 million slaves in the world today. 30 million. many of them children sold by their parents to survive. I was reading this morning the lectionary for today, which is a list of passages that they're reading around the world. And churches all around the world, they're reading and preaching from these passages. And one of the passages is Psalm 114. And I was so encouraged by the courage of the language. When Israel went forth from Egypt, the house of Jacob from a people of strange language, Judah became his sanctuary, Israel his dominion. The sea looked and fled. The Jordan turned back. The mountains skipped like rams, the hills like lambs. What ails you, O sea, that you flee? O Jordan, that you turn back? O mountains, that you skip like rams, O hills like lambs. Tremble, O earth, before the Lord, before the God of Jacob, who turned the rock into pools of water, the flint into a fountain of water. So risky, so courageous, the language. I'm a church kid. I was just looking for that. Thank you. I'm a church kid, raised in Eugene, went to school at Oregon State, worked for a while at Western. And when I graduated from Oregon State, I was all full of Jesus love and energy and wanted to change the world. And I was 21 and idealistic. So I climbed on a plane 3.5 weeks after graduation. I was 21 years old and I moved to the other side of the world. And Albania had just, the wall had just fallen and no foreigners had lived there in 50 years. And I was one of the first ones to move in. And I moved in with a Muslim family and I lived there for 2.5 years and just had the greatest adventures. I made friends who didn't speak my language and came from backgrounds totally different than mine. One of my first friends was a guy named Eugen Carranza, and Eugen was a Jesus follower. And he lived in a southern city, and he would take me home on the weekends to spend time with his family. And I remember he wanted me to come home with him for Easter, my first year in Albania. So we take this bus down to southern Albania, this little tiny village with cobblestone streets and a beautiful city up in the mountains. And we stayed with his parents. And I remember on Saturday evening after dinner, we'd had a big dinner together and we were playing backgammon in the dining room and sitting around talking. And about 9 o'clock at night, maybe 8:30, Genny grabs me by the shirt. He's like, "Come on, we have to go." "What are you talking about? It's 8:30 at night. It's Saturday." He's like, "No, we have to go. It's Easter." "What are you talking?" So we grab our jackets and we go out of his little flat and we go down the stairs and out onto the street. We go to the streets until the concrete ends and it becomes cobblestone, and we follow the cobblestone until it ends and it becomes dirt. Then we walk on that until it becomes the hillside. And I stop at the foot of the hill now, and it's just mountains ahead of us. And he's like, "Come on. It's Easter." So we find a path, and we start scrambling up this hill. We climb for 10 or 15 minutes, and the hill levels off, and there's another hill. And he keeps walking up. And as we go, the farther we go, the more we're like being passed by like little groups of children, like running up the mountain. And we would come upon elderly folk that were having a hard time getting up. And we'd go a spell, and some old lady would take my arm, some villager, and I would lead her up the hill, and I'd help her over rocks. And we just whoever needed it, and we're climbing for over an hour. And after about an hour, we keep climbing, and we come to another place where the hill kind of levels off. And this time it levels off, and there's a plateau the size of several soccer fields on top of a mountain in the middle of nowhere in the Balkans under the stars. And it's flat, lit by moonlight. And in the middle of this giant plateau is this little tiny stone church that looks like something out of a Tolkien book, right? And under communism, they had scraped every church off the face of Albania. There was this, the dictator hated Christianity, and it scraped them all. And this one little church they just had never gotten around to because it was on top of a mountain in the middle of nowhere, right? This little tiny stone. So we get up over and of course, Genny grabs me and he's like, come on, it's Easter. So we're like scrambling across the plateau and we get over to the little church. And the church is no larger than your kitchen, right? This little tiny stone building. He says, come on, let's go inside. So we go around the side, and there's this little opening, and I go inside the church. I'm standing in this little room with only maybe 8 or 10 Albanian peasants standing there in the darkness. And on one end is a little altar, a little stone shelf with some soot-covered icons and a few candles. The wax almost all the way to the bottom, flowing over the edge. And compared to Albanians, I'm huge. So I sort of back to the back, right? And I put my shoulders against the stone wall, and I just stand there, just young and dumb, right? And I just trying to understand what's going on. And I'm looking around at the candle-lit faces of these Albanians standing there trying to pray. And I remember, you know, a kid who had gone to church 3 times a week his entire life. And I'm standing there, and it occurs to me this might be the first time these people have ever stood in a church in their life. It might be the first time they've ever tried to pray in this way. I wonder who they think God is. I wonder what they think God is like. Okay, so we're kind of a weird family. My family, I've got 3 boys, my wife, and we live in a communal household, and it's a multiracial, multi-class household. And currently we share our home with 2 Navajo men. And they're just a real gift to us. And our neighborhood doesn't really have a church in it. We live in post-Christian Portland. And so for most of our life, we've hosted a sacred meal on Sunday evenings where we do some scripture reading, and my wife and I write a little liturgy, and we take communion around the table, and then we have a little feast, and we sit together and talk about faith and life. And the people who come are not all Christians, but they all want meaning, and they all think Jesus is groovy, and so they come. And 2 of the people at our table fell in love. They were both about 50 years old. And they fell in love and decided they wanted to get married to each other. And so a couple years ago, they got married at the Oregon coast with their toes in the surf. And they asked me if I would perform the ceremony, which I was, you know, super excited to do. And so I wore a Palestinian robe my wife had bought for me on a trip. And there was some pageantry to it. And I love a little pageantry. And after the service, we were up at the house where they were having the reception. And the food was flowing and conversation was rich. And I remember I was standing at a standing table, right, with about 6 people. And we were standing, we were talking afterwards and eating and laughing and drinking wine. And we were talking about faith. We were talking about the service and the Jesus elements of the church service, the wedding ceremony. And this one woman suddenly says, she says, "I reject what you believe. You, how could you? How could you even claim to believe this thing, this ridiculous story, this foolish story, this stupid story that you think you believe, a story that is based on child abuse, a story based on a father who doesn't have the guts to do things himself, so he sends his son to go be tortured and murdered because he is such a coward. It is a story of child abuse. It is ridiculous. It is vile, and I reject it, and I reject you." Which, as you can imagine, changes the tone of a reception a little bit. And this group of half a dozen people, and now the crowd around the table is kind of growing. And after sort of a long silence and no one really knowing what to say, I said, kind of looked around the room, since I was the officiant, I was the official religious person in the space. So I just said, sort of quietly, I said, "You know what? I'm with her. I'm with her. I'm on her team. Because if that's the story, if the story is a story of child abuse, then I don't want it either. And I'm getting out." See, the problem isn't that she's wrong. The problem is no one's ever told her a better story. That's the problem. So I grew up in a Baptist church. It's a good Baptist church, a good conservative Baptist church. I'm very thankful for my church, despite what I'm about to say. And in our church, we had a lot of rules. And a lot of the rules are the normal rules we talk about and people make fun of. You know, but a lot of the rules were unspoken rules that we never really talk about. But we all knew the rules. We all knew the rules. Even the ones that no one ever said out loud, but there were these rules. So, for instance, in our book of rules, our imaginary book that we all carried around with us all the time, like every time you picked up your Bible, there was this big book of rules on top of it we had to carry around. There was a whole chapter in our book of rules on how you're allowed to talk about God. And everybody played by the same rules, and we all knew the same rules, and we all knew the shame if you drifted outside the rules at all. So we stayed right inside the rules. Let me give you an example of what I mean about the rules. And this was in my church. Your experience may have been different. This was our experience. So when you're talking about God, or if you were praying to God, you were allowed to call God a lion. That was legal. That was in the, it's okay in the rule, in the chapter on talking about God. You could call God a lion. It was fine. Maybe because Lion of the Tribe of Judah, maybe, but more likely because 20th century's favorite theologian wrote children's books where God was a lion, so therefore it was okay. But you could call God a lion. "God, you're a lion. Pray to you, oh, Lion of God. God, Lion, Lion, God." But you couldn't call God a bear. We all knew you weren't allowed to, you know? Meanwhile, bears are powerful. You know, a grizzly bear could probably kick a lion's butt, really. I mean, in the moment, pretty strong, pretty powerful, pretty strong, pretty loyal, pretty compassionate, you know, care for their young, you know. Seems like we could mine a lot from the metaphor of a bear when talking about God, but you weren't allowed to. Lion was okay, bear wasn't okay. It was just a rule. We all knew it. It's kind of a dumb rule. It's kind of an arbitrary rule. But for some reason, bears were off limits. I don't know. Maybe they sounded too, what, native. I don't know. You could call God a rock. It's legal. God is my rock. God is a rock. Strong rock, powerful rock. I could call God a rock. I could pray and say, "God, you are my rock." But I couldn't say, "God, you are my crystal." Even though crystals are just really, really hard, super beautiful rocks. But you weren't allowed to say it. It was against the rules. We all knew it. So you, when praying, you would never say, God, you are my crystal. Probably because crystals are too Portland. I don't know. To Eugene. You could call God light. God, you are light. You are light to my path. You are light to my feet. But you couldn't call God a rainbow. Even though rainbows are actually in the Bible, and they're just really beautiful light. But you weren't, and it's kind of arbitrary, and there are these arbitrary rules. And the older I get, and the more that I drift into the world of writing and poetry and different things, and quite frankly, reading the Psalms and the sort of scandalous language that was in the lectionary this morning, I start to want to see people unleash creativity around their faith and not feel so restrained. I think that repression holds us back. So I want to do a really quick experiment this morning. I want everybody in the room to write a poem right now. Now, I'm going to make it really easy on you. It's a one-line poem, and I'm going to write most of it. You just have to fill in the blanks. It's a one-line poem. It's a simile. God is like blank because blank. I want you to come up with an original simile, an original metaphor for God that's yours, that means something to you. Think of something that's meaningful to you. God is like this thing because God is also Bing, right? It can be anything. It can be playful. It can be serious. God is like a river. God is like my pancreas. Though I'm sure he's there, I'm not really sure what he's doing most of the time. God is like the Republican Party. God is like Apollo. God is like my church. God is like my grandson. So think to yourself, come up with one, with an original poem. One line, just a one-line poem. I had a student once write an entire paper, like an 8-page paper, on how Jesus is like heroin. He was a recovering addict. Jesus is like heroin. Fantastic paper. I gave him an A. God is like blank because blank. You got one? Okay, turn to somebody next to you and share your one-line poem with them. All right, has everybody shared their poem? All right. I believe in the community of the faith and volunteering one another. So if you heard a particularly good one-line poem and you'd like to volunteer the person who shared it to you, please feel free to do so. I want to hear a couple. Yes. Steve said... Can everybody hear that? God is like my motorcycle because he goes where I go. Very nice. Well done, Steve. Sir.
It's the inside off to explain it. God is like digga digga because he can't be contained.
Digga digga.
So when he gets excited, he's like digga 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 because he's excited.
So digga digga is what he says? All right. Fantastic. If you can't see God in your grandkids, I don't know where. Sir, God is like a physician because he healed me. Fantastic and personal. Yes, ma'am. So good. You guys are firing. This is great. I'll tell you guys that that Silverton Friends was not this excited to share when I was when I was there, sir.
God is like water.
We need water and we are water. Nice. Very good. One or two more? This is fun. Come on back here, somebody. Yes, ma'am.
My husband said God is like his father because his father loved everybody.
Oh, it's so great. And a great testimony. Thank you all very much for going with me on that ride. So my first years in Albania were great, and they're full of adventures, and I ended up spending all of my 20s overseas. It ended up being about a 10-year run where I was living in several different countries. And mostly my job was to go into hot spots in the world and start new missions, new ministries. And so I worked mostly in difficult access countries and spent a fair amount of time sneaking across borders. And two times I was evacuated by the State Department for terrorism. So that's fun. But my time overseas didn't end well. Living at that sort of level of octane, especially when you're, I think, a particularly immature person, which I was and probably still am, and I didn't really have the resources to manage that level of stress and pain and the level of chaos and hurt that I was experiencing and witnessing every day. So by the time I was in my late 20s, I was a mess. And I actually got fired from my job pretty publicly and pretty violently. And it's very shameful. And when I came back to the States, the shame was pretty overwhelming. And I wasn't really sure what I could believe anymore. I was 29, 30 years old. I wasn't really sure what I could believe. And it is fascinating, the sensation inside of me of the divine and how comfortable God was with my chaos and my doubt and the fact that I wasn't sure that I could believe anymore. And even in the midst of that sense of chaos, I had the sense that God was like, good, now we can get to work. I've kind of been waiting for this because we got some stuff to rebuild. There's some broken beliefs in you that I don't even recognize the God that you believe in. So let's talk. So one of the things that happened early on when I was 30 years old was someone introduced me to an ancient piece of theological writing, an ancient piece of theological art. And actually a piece of Russian icon from the 16th century that was originally written by a guy named Andrei Rublev. And it was written at a time when Russia was about to explode. Russia was relationally on fire. Brother against brother kind of revolution was about to take place. And in the midst of this pain, this national pain, a fairly young priest, monk, who was a brilliant theologian and iconographer, he wrote an icon, a piece of art. And are we ready to throw that up? Thank you. And I don't know how you feel about icons. I don't want to make a big case about icons. And if you think they're a little suspicious, that's fine. Just run with me for a minute on this. I happen to love them, but that's a whole other conversation. But this particular icon has been very, very helpful to me in my faith walk. And it was introduced to me at this time when I was hurting. And it's called the Icon of the Holy Trinity, and it's based after Genesis chapter 17 or 18, when the three visitors come and they visit Abraham under the tree, and the three visitors say that Abraham's going to have a son. And so it's taking that historical event, and using that as a metaphor to explain some theological ideas. And I would argue this particular theological document is just as important as the Confessions of Augustine or the Institutes of John Calvin or the Chronicles of Narnia. and helping us understand faith. And while we could talk about it all day long, I won't bore you with all that. I just want to show you one thing. Okay, so the three figures are representations of the life of God. It's not a picture of God, because we all know from the Ten Commandments, you don't draw God. But it's a representation, it's a metaphor of God sitting together in fellowship. And as you notice, the three are sitting and they're gazing at one another, and the tilt of their head and the positions of their body all communicate this sort of deference, this love. So it's been called the dance of love, this particular icon. There's a dance of love, like they're spinning in love around the table together, lost in one another, okay? And the front of the table is left open as if to say, pull up a chair. Join the dance. I love that. And the three figures, in the middle of the table, you'll notice that there's a cup. And the cup is certainly the cup of fellowship, like you have here on your altar. But it's also, very importantly, the cup of suffering. Historically, one of the most important symbols in church history and Christian history is the cup of suffering. And it's the cup of suffering. If you notice, all three figures are equal distance from the cup. All three figures are co-equally participating in the cup of suffering. Now, here's the thing I really just want you to notice about this. All three are equal distance from the cup of suffering, the middle of the table, but if you also look at their bodies are also shaped as a goblet. Their bodies are shaped like a cup. And so not only are they sharing the cup of suffering, but their bodies are making up a cup of suffering together. So suffering is both something that God participates in externally and also something that God is the one who suffers. Christ, Man of Sorrows, is one of the earliest names from the first century that we have, that people used to refer to Jesus as the Man of Sorrows. Okay, you following with me so far? So, Isaiah 63:9, and all their afflictions, he was afflicted, and the angel of his presence seared them. In his love and in his mercy, he redeemed them, and he lifted them and carried them all the days of old. Isaiah 16:11, God says, my heart intones like a harp for you. Jeremiah 48:32, God says, more than the weeping of Jazor, I will weep for you. Isaiah 42:14, God said, like a woman in labor, I groan for you. I both gasp and pant for you. Isaiah 49:15, God says, can a woman forget the nursing child? I will never forget you. Matthew 23:37, Jesus said, Jerusalem, O Jerusalem, how often I have wanted to gather you together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. John 11:35, Jesus wept. The God of sorrow, the God of suffering, is an aspect of God, of theology, of understanding God that I don't think we talk about enough in the West. Our brothers and sisters in the East, it's been more regular, like the Eastern Church and Russia and other places in history. So I'm standing in that house above the ocean, that standing table, the crowd gathering around, and the woman says, I reject what you believe, your story of child abuse. And I said, I agree, because we need a better story. And they were just silent for like 15, 20 seconds. A whole room, just standing there, staring. Finally, someone says, so what's a better story? I'm like, well, that's the question, right? Do you have one? Do you have a better story than a story of child? Because if all you have is the father sent the son to be punished, It does kind of sound like a story of child abuse. Is there more to it? And so someone said, well, you tell a better story. I'm like, okay, I'll try. And I looked at the lady and I said, let me tell you something. There's this ancient Russian icon that's become very meaningful to me. And in the icon, I want to describe what I described to you. And this ancient theologian, in the midst of a country ripping itself apart, wanted to give the idea of God's character and what could bring their country back together. And the aspect of God's character was that God suffers and invites you to pull up a chair. God's character, God's nature is to suffer. So your story of child abuse, I honestly disagree with. That's not my story. My story is that when the Trinity was sitting in eternity and the incarnation was coming, Jesus didn't draw the short straw. Jesus drew the long straw. Jesus didn't have to become incarnated. Jesus wanted to become incarnated. That it was the greatest joy set before him to endure the cross, despising the shame. That Jesus got to put God's character on display. The way that God is at all times and all places throughout eternity. This is God, the God who suffers on our behalf. The God who takes on our pain on our behalf. The God who takes on our hurt on our behalf. All the times and all places at all times. The cross is not an anomaly in eternity. The cross is just a demonstration of eternity. And when the cross took place, it was the Father holding the veil open on one side and the Spirit holding the veil on the other side so we could see through the cross to the way of eternity that this is who God is, who loves you and suffers for you and with you and in what you're suffering. This is what God feels, that God is suffering more than we are in all things. That's the story that I believe. Amen. And if that's the story, if that's the way God is, then we've got something to say to millions who don't have electricity because of Hurricane Irma. And there's some level of hope for suffering families in Myanmar. And we know that 30 million slaves are not living alone and isolated, but God cares for them. And I believe in some mystical way God is with them. And for you and your loss and your loved ones that are gone and your broken heart and the ways you're experiencing pain and illness in your life and in the lives of people that you love, that God's suffering with you. Doesn't explain it, doesn't take it away, but sure is good to know you're not alone. And God's like, I know you're hurting. Pull up a chair, join the table. As I stood with my shoulder blades against that stone wall in that little tiny church, candlelight flickering on the faces, Kenny grabbed me by the shirt and he's like, come on, let's go. He pulled me back out of the church. We ran around the other side. When we got around the other side, at this point, the plateau had filled with people. There were hundreds of people in the moonlight, under the stars, on top of this mountain in the middle of nowhere. And against the backside of the church, a couple of young priests had carried a box up the mountain, and they placed it next to the church. And this little old man, bent, as old as dust, climbs up on the box. And they hand him an old, like, World War II microphone with a speaker One of them held the speaker up, and this old man began to preach the gospel to these hundreds of people sitting in the moonlight. He told the story of Jesus who came to be with us and to suffer. And about the time the clock ticked to midnight, he got to the part of the story where Jesus rose again. He got to the end, and the old man sort of mustered up as much energy as he could get. He looked out over the crowd, and he yelled as loud as he could, "Jesus is alive!" And like two voices from the back were like, "He is alive indeed!" In Albanian, but you can imagine it. The old man was sort of discouraged by the response. He's like, these people have not been educated. This old man who'd probably been hiding in northern Greece for 50 years, you know. He's like, "Jesus is alive!" And this time about 50 people went, "He is alive indeed," with a little more energy. And he was like, "Okay." And he's like, "Jesus is alive!" And the whole mountain rocked as people yelled to the top of their lungs, "He is alive indeed." Seeming satisfied, the old man turned, and from one of the young men, he took a candle. And the young man lit it, and he held the candle up above his head. He said, "The light of God, the hope of the world." And everybody in the mountaintop pulled out candles. And he leaned forward and lit the first two or three candles in the crowd. And then they turned and lit and turned and lit. And within minutes, the top of the mountain was aglow. Hundreds and hundreds of candles. And Genny and I are standing towards the front. He grabs me by the shirt. He's like, "Come on. This is the best part." He drags me over to the side of the mountain, and we hung our toes over the edge. And we stood there for the next hour because the goal was to get the candle back to your neighborhood and put it in the window of your home. We stood there and watched little streams of light go down through the crags and valleys and paths. The mountain, as everybody went back to their little village or back to their little or back to Korcha, the little city, and in Korcha, which was way down in the bottom of the valley, we actually could watch people go through the streets of the town. So they were trying to get the light of God, the hope of the world, back to their neighborhood. So, your story is unique. Your pain is unique. The way that you suffer for the world is unique. And in that, God is eternally creative to show up in your pain and what wakes you up in the middle of the night and what makes you cry when you're alone. The way God reveals God's self to you is unique in that. And whatever that is, it's the light of God, the hope of the world. And my prayer for you, I don't know you, is that you can take whatever that is home and put it in the front window of your house for your neighbors to see and share with your family so we can all pull a chair up to the table of God, your neighbors, your family, and your neighbors on the other side of the world who are suffering. Lord bless you and keep you.
Thanks, Tony.